Hi, we here at the North American Christians in Social Work want to thank you for selecting this continuing education course. We appreciate your interest in pursuing ongoing trainings sensitive to the thoughtful integration of faith, social work practice, and spirituality. We hope that this training meets or exceeds your expectations and is useful to you. If you have any questions during or after the training, please don't hesitate to contact us at info@nacsw.org. Thanks again and enjoy the training.
So without further ado, I'm going to turn it over to Dr. Howard, and we look forward to what you're going to share with us.
Thank you so much. Thank you. So did anybody just get off the plane and fly in? Okay. So take a deep breath, right? It's a lot traveling. And how many New Englanders are in the room? Okay, a few. How about anybody from the West Coast? Southerners? Okay. Midwest? Okay. Am I missing any geographical area?
Yeah.
Mid-Atlantic. Okay. Quick flight. D.C. Excellent. So I spent my formative years in Massachusetts and then the last 22 years in Rhode Island. And now I'm in South Florida. And hopefully we'll have the remainder of my existence on Earth in South Florida. I'm really enjoying it. I've been there a year. I'm assistant professor at Florida Atlantic University. But it was so lovely. I flew into Providence, driving through rural Rhode Island and rural Connecticut, and just really enjoying the trees, because it's just palm trees where I live. So it's nice to have color and all the characteristic homes in New England, and it's home to me. So it was really lovely driving here. So my area of research is maternal substance use, and I've been doing this research for about the last 7 years. But what we're going to talk about today, it's really going to be interactive. We're going to do a lot of work together at your table, and hopefully learn from one another and grow. But it can be translated to also adolescents and adult males. It's not just women, a lot of the concepts that we're going to be speaking about today. So how many social workers are working with substance use field? Okay, excellent. So I hope that you can really contribute a lot today. That would be great. And how about in hospital settings? Anyone? Okay, good. So you're impacted too. And then what about criminal justice? Any forensic social workers? Because that definitely, obviously, is another intersection with substance use. So can anybody shout out why maybe they were interested in coming to this workshop? Okay, impacted by the opioid crisis. Okay, excellent. So gaining some clinical knowledge in that area. Excellent. How about personal? You don't have to get to share. But raise your hand if you know somebody, not in your professional life, but personal life, that's been impacted. It could be a friend. It could be a family member. Yeah. So almost 50% in this room, which is pretty significant. I was last week meeting with the director of education at the Hanley Foundation, which is in South Florida, and they do a lot of education and awareness around substance use disorder. And I always get the question, why are you doing research in substance use? Why do you care about this? And it's a personal question, and usually it's not a question that people ask on a regular basis. Like, why are you invested in this? Why are you doing this? And she said, she was about my age, and she said, I'm in it because my 21-year-old died of a heroin overdose. And she said, I'm in this because I want to try to make an impact to prevent this from other young adults. So it's impacting everyone. And it happened 3 years ago, her daughter dying. And I asked her, I said, I'm sure your daughter was struggling with a lot of different things. Such a difficult to disease. And she said, she shared with me, she was raped when she was 16. And that's when she started using. And you'll see when I share some of the studies, for both men and women, trauma is significant comorbidity with substance use and a trauma experience. I've had personal and professional of why I do this work. And so if you want to know more about it after the workshop, I can share that with you. Is there a question? Oh, there's a seat. Okay. I just wanted to, anybody familiar with National Survey Drug Use and Health? I wanted to just give the latest statistics that just came out from the government. The NSDUH does surveys. It's the largest database in our country, and they survey all non-institutionalized adults 12 and older in the country. So it really gives a it's very, you know, highly generalizable, and it gives a really nice representation of what's going on right now. So in this past year, there's 19.7 million people with a substance use disorder. Everybody familiar with the term substance use disorder? It shifted from DSM-4 to DSM-5. And now it really is characterized by a problematic behavior that's impacting work and social functioning. So again, this is a diagnosis substance use disorder. It's not initiates people that are using for the first time. This is somebody that really has significant clinical impairment. So it's very high. And the highest is alcohol. And though we're talking about opioids today, again, it's, you know, the Surgeon General really encouraged that we don't just isolate one substance, because a lot of these issues and concerns encompass also alcohol and other substances. And most, this isn't mutually exclusive, meaning if you have alcohol, you're not doing something else. So there's most polysubstance use, and people that do substance use work, you probably already know this, right, that they've also used other substances, or they do alcohol, and maybe they misuse an anti-anxiety medication. But the second highest is illicit drugs. That is all underneath it, marijuana down to prescription stimulants. And then, so marijuana is the highest after alcohol, and then the prescription pain reliever, of course, is your opioids, but it's also benzodiazepines. But of those different prescribed drugs, opioids is the highest still. Any questions with that? With the prescription stimulant misuse, that's very problematic with college age. Everybody knows social learning theory. It's similar with marijuana use and misuse of Adderall. That young adults feel that there's nothing wrong with it. You know, that if I take an Adderall, I'll be able to concentrate more on the final exam. So there's real increase of emergency room visits with stimulant of misuse, especially with the younger age group. And it's really common. Anybody have adolescents in the room? I don't know if you have you heard any of your kids say, "Oh, you know, my friends use it all the time before a test," or it's really considered commonplace, and not even considering that there might be a side effect or a concern. So it's good to know to be able to screen for that. So this is again from the same data source, and anybody can access all these slides. It's the, again, NSDUH, National Survey of Drug Use and Health. There's over 50 slides. I'm only showing a few. But if you want to be able to share back to your teams or groups that you're working with, this is an excellent database, and it's the most recent. But this is really interesting, because they in the survey, they asked, what is the source of the prescription pain relievers, right? And you can see only 34% are actually prescribed by a physician. The largest amount, really the other half, over 53%, are either given by someone, bought from someone, or bought from a friend or relative, or given from for free, or taken without asking. You know, going in the medicine cabinet and seeing if there's anything. That's Is that surprising to anyone? No, it's over half. So does anybody do regular screens with their clients or patients and asking, you know, where did you access the prescription opioids? Do you do a verbal screening?
Yeah.
Well, and that's good that you asked that question. And so my 25 years of clinical social work practice was in healthcare before I went into academia and strictly research. So I've worked mostly with more physicians and nurses than hospital social workers, right? Because you're on a team and you're with that interprofessional team versus just social workers and a lot of integrative health, what you're talking about. But it's common in the emergency room or different areas to hear, oh, that person is drug seeking, or that person is this. And really, if you just take away one thing from our workshop, that we think about how we use this language and how it impacts people that are coming in for help. And that's what we're really going to be kind of digging down deep about that. But it happens all the time, you know, the language and thinking about somebody's behavior and labeling that. So I just wanted to, again, show the people that have used marijuana for the very first time. And you can see 12 to 17, how much it's grown, you know, in the last year. And connecting again back to social learning theory, if young adolescents and adolescents believe that it is not harmful, then, and you know, their peers are using it, then it's going to be more acceptable and you're going to have more initiates, first-time users of marijuana. Harvard University has done a lot of studies on the marijuana use and the impact on the brain in adolescents. So I don't work a lot with adolescents, but you can always provide psychoeducation. That there are some studies that show that it impacts the brain. It decreases academic functioning. It decreases motivation. And because when does the brain finally, we say that it's developed? Anybody know the age?
25.
Yes. So you're using a substance when your brain isn't fully developed. So Harvard in the last few years has done some studies that you could find on Google Scholar. So specifically heroin use disorder, this age group is also 18 to 25. Many of the fatal overdoses are this age group. So it's really this emerging adulthood stage. Anybody working with this age group, emerging adulthood? So 18 to 25-year-olds? Yeah. Okay. What's going on in this at this time period, emerging adulthood, like developmentally? What's happening? Relationships. What am I going to do with my life? Yeah, a lot. There's a lot going on. In where I'm in South Florida, you know, like every area in the United States, the opioid crisis has had such a significant impact. But many people from the Northeast and Mid-Atlantic send their emerging adult children down to South Florida. And there's been a lot of flagrant, non-ethical programs that really don't have any evidence-based practice. And it's just been a revolving door. And so many young adults have died. It's absolutely not only unethical, but a tragedy. Okay, so again, I told you that my area is maternal substance use, and I worked in a women's oncology and birthing hospital for 21 years, but there's something that really excites me about working with and doing research in this area is because pregnancy brings what? Change. Yes. It's this incredible opportunity for thinking about life differently. So to capitalize on social work interventions at an opportune time is for me so exciting. Is anybody familiar with the trans-theoretical model of behavior change? Okay, so pre-contemplation, contemplation. You got the next one?
Preparation.
Preparation, then action, maintenance. And now there's another one too, like a closing, but with a substance use disorder, it's always maintenance because it's a chronic disease. But usually in pregnancy, using that model, you're at pre-contemplation or contemplation or action. So it's really, you know, thinking about the stages, it's this wonderful opportunity. So support, not stigma. That, again, going back to the use of our language, it's this amazing opportunity to provide support. But anybody with a substance use disorder experiences stigma. So just to be thinking about how can we, as individuals and social workers, be supportive and not stigmatic. Okay, so this is kind of the major theories that we're going to talk about today. Trauma-informed approach, shame resilience theory, self-determination, shared decision-making. Just a brief overview, because you really could go into depth at each of these. This is my daughter. I usually drag her to conferences. This was in Nashville, Tennessee, and it was the National Advocacy for Pregnant Women and the National Perinatal Association. And at the time, 3 years ago, the government had just created a policy that if there's any substance use in pregnancy, then it's a criminal offense and women can be incarcerated. And I was on a panel with four women that actually had been arrested and incarcerated right after pregnancy. It's not a policy anymore. And the NPA and the National Advocacy of Pregnant Women really were very instrumental in that. So now it is not considered a criminal offense. But really, it was really scary. That's why it's really important for social workers to be also involved in what's happening on a policy level and how that influences micro practice. But a person who uses drugs can also love and care for their family. To be really transparent, when I started in 1992 in my social work career, I was pediatrics and I was child-centered. And I did not believe this at all. I thought, if somebody used substances while they were pregnant or while they had young children, then they're monsters. And that's being really transparent. And that was how I felt. I don't feel that way anymore. But it took me many, many years. And, you know, I'll share with you a little bit, too, of my journey. But I think we all have biases. We all have personal values. We all have been impacted too, in some way, some of us personally, by substance use, and that can all impact how we interact with other people and what our viewpoints are. But as social workers, what your values and viewpoints really influence the decisions we make, right? In helping or harming people. So this is a qualitative health study that I conducted a few years ago with 20 pregnant women who self-disclosed that they had an opioid use disorder in the New England region. There was actually one from Connecticut, a few from Maine and Massachusetts and Rhode Island. But as you can see, the demographic statistics, there was polysubstance use. As I shared, it's very common, you know, to have polysubstance use with someone that has a substance use disorder. But what I wanted to do, I wanted to understand. I knew what the recommendations were from ACOG, the American Academy of Gynecology and Obstetrical Medicine, and SAMHSA, and American Medical Association of medication-assisted treatment. There was a real a lot of variability in treatment recommendations with pregnant women, though, and this is across the country. So it wasn't one study that really looked at what the patient's perspective was and what she wanted and what was going on in her life. So that was the reason why, the purpose. And this is kind of a conceptual framework of the story that they shared with me and the themes that developed from the study. How it's analyzed, it's called interpretive phenomenological analysis. I don't know if anybody's read phenomenological studies, but it's your understanding the lived experience of a particular homogeneous group, but then you're also understanding the meanings and perceptions that they have of that experience. And then the interpretive piece is that the researcher is interpreting the data. So you also bring in your theoretical lens and your framework. So that's how these main themes arose. But you can kind of see the pregnant woman is central. And is there options or is there not? Methadone, buprenorphine, detoxification. There's many parts in the state, in the country. Just in where I'm from, in South Florida, in Fort Lauderdale, there's one in Broward County that does detoxification, and then the other one does buprenorphine. So it's really state-specific. It's also cultural practice of the group that you're in. And sometimes it can be on a policy level. So the few years ago in Tennessee, they were actually mandating detoxification for pregnant women to avoid prosecution, not doing that anymore. But these all have implications in how it impacts the patient. And in that, you know, substance use disorder is a chronic disease, and SAMHSA and other major groups are shifting that to think about this as we think about diabetes and asthma and how somebody can heal from the disease and recover, but also it's a constant lifetime maintenance. And this recovery relapse, that relapse is part of it. If anybody is diabetic or is has asthma, we have relapses all the time. The relapse rates for, you know, somebody has diabetes is 50 to 70% in terms of diet. And it's just a constant because it's a behavior and it's a life change and it's very, very difficult. And then the other piece is these two parallel fears. Anybody work in or has heard of neonatal abstinence syndrome? That's what happens with substance exposure. In utero, so it's not a disease. It is a syndrome. It's treatable. There's actually at Yale University an excellent pediatric researcher who's doing great work in the treatment of NAS. It's very family centered, and they're having excellent positive outcomes. So, decreased pharmacological interventions for the neonates, decreased length of hospital stay. And guess what the main intervention is, if it's not pharmacological? You want to take a guess? For the neonate. What do you know about puppies, kittens, or infants in terms of infant mental health? Yes, the mother is the intervention. And it's the kangaroo care, it's the closeness. If anybody studied attachment theory, it's capitalizing on that. So a lot of the studies that's like Dr. Patrick in Tennessee, that a baby with NAS can be up to $53,000. But part of this cost was that the baby is taken out of the normal newborn room with the mom and put in a NICU environment and separated. So that cost is much higher. So this physician at Yale is doing phenomenal work in this area. But the moms have this incredible fear that my baby will have neonatal abstinence syndrome, a legitimate fear. And then child protective services. So, you know, you're pregnant and you have these two parallel fears.
What is neonatal abstinence syndrome?
Sure, absolutely. Thank you for asking. So if somebody's, and it could be, it could even be exposure to antidepressants, benzodiazepine, so prescriptions, but it's predominantly mostly opioids. It could be medication-assisted treatment. It could be methadone. It could be buprenorphine. It could be heroin. It could be prescribed opioids. What we see in the whole, methadone usually has the more severe cases of NAS. But again, the mom's on treatment. So just kind of think about that. because methadone is a long-acting opioid agonist. So it stays in the system longer for the infant. So it's a syndrome, and the Dr. Andre Jones of UNC at Chapel Hill has done really the first developmental outcomes. The babies are now 3, and here's the average. They're still in the average range, and they're doing fine. So it's a treatable syndrome. It's not like fetal alcohol syndrome, which is not, you know, it's something that is not, you know, reversible.
So what are the symptoms?
So the symptoms are fussy, inconsolability. The worst case scenario would be unable to eat. But the researchers that's doing work at Yale, the babies are doing incredible. So I don't want you to write this down. I just want you to think of this in the head, in your head. And I don't want you to share it either, so you can be honest with yourself. Are you ready for my question? What do you feel in your lifetime was the worst thing that you've ever done? Just take a moment and think about that. We all have something. There's no perfect people in the room, right? I know with mine, I have a lot of regret and shame. Now imagine if I had to tell you all. Imagine you all had to tell me. Imagine you had to tell everybody at the hospital. Yeah. Very, very difficult to ask for help because of the intense shame. So this is another pictorial of those themes, just to kind of understand, okay, this decision-making process, two things are going on. The perception of self, of how I feel about myself, and that conceptual framework. And then down here, what are my choices? Do I have options? Do I have a voice in my treatment as somebody with an opioid use disorder? And now I'm pregnant. Really important to note, never, ever, ever in a case, clinically or in the science, has pregnancy preceded substance use disorder. Substance use disorder always is first, and then the pregnancy. That's important to think about because, you know, society says, how could you do this? How could you do this, right? But if we shift it and say, this is something that I'm suffering with, and now I'm pregnant, and what can we do to support? So I'm just going to show you a couple of slides on the data, just so you can kind of understand what the experience is. But this woman, and these are just pseudonyms, they're not their real names, I would take away my addiction and start all over again and be normal and like I'm just everybody else, someone that isn't judged and treated like a normal woman, and take your baby home and have a nursery and have a bonding experience. Yeah, it's really powerful. And I was asking her, what is the meaning of substance use to you? And what is your perception of this, that this is your identity? And that's what she shared with me. You had talked about, what was your first name?
Dolores.
You absolutely accurate. So you have the medical on one side, you have your pregnancy, you have your substance use disorder, and then you also have child protection services. There's a lot going on. But this is very common if somebody has subsequent children and the first child was maybe removed from her care and then they get pregnant again, there is this kind of negotiating, bargaining on the table. Well, if you sign over this child, then you'll be able to keep this child. Happens all the time. So people are really at this incredible dilemma of not wanting to sign over adoption, but also not wanting to lose an infant. But going on Dolores's point, a lot of this really is the sociological and environmental factors, because people that interface with Child Protective Services mostly are in lower socioeconomic status, because there's many people that are higher privilege, white privilege, that are undetected, and they're misusing prescription opioids. I believe my personal framework is health disparities is everything in this conversation. But that, you know, that's a good point. Yes, we always take in the biological also. So this again goes to what Dolores, you were saying. You are in substance use. Okay, so you've seen this experience. But two women, one was from Maine and one was from Massachusetts, and they both said the same thing, different interviews. It feels like my child or infant is being kidnapped, and I'm watching it, and there's nothing I can do about it. Powerlessness. And I haven't had personal experience with DCF removing my children, but I could totally identify with that feeling. And I can't imagine how these women survive this experience, really. And some of them, like you said, are already in treatment. And that's connected also to relapse. And that's the study I'm doing right now is, how is relapse connected to removal of children? From a community participatory action research. I mean, we know it clinically and anecdotally, but I want to publish it in the science that, and using an infant mental health framework. Anybody followed all the immigration issues and all the studies that came out, how it's harmful to children's development? We do it every single day in the United States with infants removal from families. So our advocacy and the science has to the importance of family preservation, the importance of mother-infant diet, not polarizing families. I don't know the statistics in all your states, but in Florida, children, adults that have children in custody, 80% were in DCF as children. I don't know if anybody knows statistics in their state. But that's something to think about, right? That's intergenerational trauma. That is systemic oppression. We need to improve. We need to improve our system of care with that statistic. So this is the SAMHSA definition, but I think it's also important to think about community trauma, community violence, people that are exposed to, it's everywhere, right? And how this impacts somebody physically, emotionally, and can impact also spiritual well-being, right? I just wanted to put up these trauma-informed care from SAMHSA, this model, which is, it aims to be culturally, historically, and gender sensitive, but include the client's voice and try to promote collaboration. You might want to write this down. I'm just starting to read about it. Healing. It's called HCE, and it is healing-centered engagement. It's a researcher in education and African American studies. He's trying to shift that we don't medicalize and just focus on the trauma, but that we focus on healing and strength-based language, that we focus on well-being and the positive, not just somebody's identity as the trauma. This is important, trauma-informed care in big systems, but I encourage you all to look up healing-centered engagement, because that's thinking about it in a different shift that and then bringing in community psychology and collectively trying to empower the individual. So that's hot off the press, and I wanted you to have that information. So I just really quickly want to mention the most recent studies that look at the comorbidity of trauma and substance use. Somebody mentioned empathy. Who mentioned empathy? You know, having an empathic approach, an empathic stance. Sometimes highlighting to people that we work with that maybe don't have empathy, understanding that the science demonstrates, the empirical literature demonstrates that people with substance use disorder have a very high incidence of trauma experience. And that usually can get people to think about it a little differently, that and especially childhood sexual abuse for women, very, very high. And substance use is a way to cope with that horrific, horrific pain. Okay, can anybody articulate the difference between shame and guilt?
Yes.
Please do. Does that have everybody's attention? What, your first name again?
Joyous.
Joyous? That's so beautiful.
Thank you.
Joyous is going to articulate shame and guilt, okay. The difference.
My understanding, guilt could be like the idiot light on your car that says, uh-oh, I broke my honor code, and there's a chance then for you to say, whoops, I'm going to do it better. It's redemptive because it can get you back on the right course. Shame, however, is just there's nothing redemptive. It's just I did horrible, and there's no recovery. There's nothing good. There's no way out, it feels like. It just is a cesspool that continues.
Yeah, that's great. That was a great definition, wasn't it? It was really articulate. And looping it back to the woman in the well, right? I can say this to you all because of this conference, but one of my favorite Bible verses is there is no condemnation in the Lord for those that love him. Because condemnation is shame, and it's so self-destructive. And the difference between is shame is I am a bad person, I am a bad mother, I am not human, you know, versus guilt. I ate the entire pint of Ben and Jerry ice cream. It's a big difference, right? And I feel guilty about that. Okay, tomorrow I'm not going to eat that much ice cream, okay? So one is adaptive, because sometimes it can shift us and chain in. One is very maladaptive, what Joya shared. Brené Brown talks a lot about shame, resilience theory. And there's actually a few studies that use the shame resilience theory in residential treatment for women with substance use. So there's actual a curriculum and a group curriculum and group work that can be used around these issues, because it is a process. It's not, okay, you know, I don't have shame today. It is a process. This is just a picture of kind of, you know, the feelings of shame. But kind of, you know, earlier we were talking about, what was your first name?
Amy Lynn,
and then in red.
Oh, Maisha.
Maisha, you were talking about how some, you know, there's discriminatory practices in your hospital. Well, I worked 21 years in Providence, same thing. And I was called on a Saturday. This was a couple of years ago before I moved. The neonatologist just found out that the mother, who was white and upper middle class, had been using illicit buprenorphine throughout her whole pregnancy. So it wasn't prescribed, and the baby was having neonatal abstinence syndrome, and she just disclosed that to him. But it was never screened. Nobody ever asked the question. It was not even thought of. But the baby, you know, was really not doing well and needed some interventions. So I was paged. And as I'm walking down to meet her and her partner, I was saying to myself, what am I going to do? You know, because I have my personal framework is not to involve DCF and try to get people to engage into treatment and to be thinking about it. But I didn't have a relationship with her. I'm just somebody that's getting paged. So I asked her if we could go into the family room, and her husband was so angry, I thought he was going to punch the wall. It was really volatile. He was very upset because he didn't know about it, and now his infant is not doing well. And she wouldn't look at me. Why isn't she looking at me? Total shame. So we went down, and then I said, why don't I use an intervention from my study and address how she's feeling? That's what evidence-based practice is, right? So we were sitting, and after I introduced myself and had permission to speak with them, it was quiet. Does anybody use the use of silence? It was really, really quiet. And then I said, were you afraid to ask for help because you felt shame? I just threw it out there. And all of a sudden, her shoulders dropped, and you could see a tear was formulating and it was trickling. And she nodded her head to me. And her husband looked at me, was quiet, and then he looked at me and said, you mean she didn't do this on purpose? I said, no, she needs help. And he literally went from his back to her to facing her and put his arm around her. And I didn't have to do anything. She went into treatment that day and got on buprenorphine. And it was really, really powerful because I stayed with the shame, you know, and how incapacitating that is, and being to ask for help. Because she's at that point in that she's asking for help. And what is the impact of infant removal? And I'm just throwing it out there. I'm just throwing it out there just to think about it, not for us to say a black and white linear decision, but just to be reflective on decisions that we make as social workers and how they can impact and change a trajectory. Safety is paramount, absolutely. I did psychiatric emergencies for 13 years. Yeah, but it's a balance. It's using your clinical skills and your expertise also with what our policies are in our state. And these policies impact, and it's classism. I mean, that's just because this issue, this for her, of a white privileged mom, she was privileged. That's the state of affairs. And I just like to acknowledge it because we all have a very serious position of power in the decisions that we make and how they impact. And anybody that has worked with adolescents that have been in the system, they're on the run, and many are trying to go back to their biological. You know, and they're such at risk for human sex trafficking. That's the highest incident. So I did, you know, thinking about it in a very big systemic way, you know, that this is a very serious problem. So we already talked about the destruction of shame and what they can do in terms of preventing people from accessing treatment. And what was the opposite of external stigma? Support. I mean, that's the all of us can do that. And just the incredible power that it can have, that we can provide. What I'd like you to write down right now is a difficult situation that you've had with a client, So you don't have to write too much, like just maybe, you know, a few words. You probably remember it. It could be, if you're a supervisor, maybe a particular, it was very difficult with a particular employee. Does everybody have someone? Okay. They're not fun. I don't know if anybody's had an experience where they've been yelled at. You know, you really have like a adversarial experience. Probably happens a lot in inpatient. And I want to shift back to the shame resilience theory. So the actual theory comes from this psychologist from 1992, The Compass of Shame. And when we experience shame in different ways and how we react and respond. So one way to cope with shame is to withdraw. Has anybody experienced that with a client or somebody that they're isolating, running and hiding? Possibly that behavior. Another way is to avoid, deny it. You don't want to think about the shame. Sometimes self-medicating with substance use or alcohol. The other two is attacking the self or attacking somebody else. So attacking others, we might have been the recipient of that. I don't know if anybody has an example of that. Turning the tables, blaming the victim, lashing out verbally or physically. Anybody experience that? Yeah. So thinking about that, that the center of that could be shame, a very, very intense shame, and that's how they're coping with it and responding. I wanted to share one other quick story about a patient who, they were a Moroccan couple, they were Muslim, and the husband brought her in asking for help because she was drinking large quantities of hard alcohol, liquor. And she was pregnant with twins. And how does everybody feel saying that? How do you feel when I say pregnant with twins? Right? This is tough stuff. Tough stuff. And it brings out something in all of us when we say that. But just step back for a minute. This woman had alcohol use disorder before. So he would bring her into the ER. We would try to talk to her. Maternal fetal medicine would try to talk to her. It was this. Constant. So I went to the attending, the head of maternal fetal medicine. I said, can we just admit her? Can you give me 5 days? So we can spend time with her and get to know her. And I don't have a diagnosis for her. I said, she's high risk, she's pregnant with twins, and she's drinking large volumes of alcohol. Okay. So she gets admitted. And as the days went on, she was a privileged Moroccan woman. She had her master's in political science. She was an undergrad biology student. She was very bright. She was married. And she was, she identified as a feminist Muslim. And I said, well, I'm going to identify as a feminist Christian. So can we meet in the middle here? And we get to know one another. And as the days went by, she shared with me that when she was living in Morocco, her uncle, for about 3 or 4 years, molested her every day. And she got through undergrad, and she got through graduate school, and then she got married, and she got pregnant, and the alcohol was more of abuse. At the end of the week, she said, yes, I'd like to go into treatment. And I just put it out there. And she went, and she had 2 healthy babies. It was a miracle. And she emailed me maybe 3 months later, postpartum, thanking me and that she was learning how to be a good mother, a good wife, and a good person. Yeah, my position, and this is just my position, and my biases and my values, I believe that substance use disorder is a chronic disease and we need to treat it as a public health response and not be punitive. However, we're moving in that direction in the health care, but the criminal justice isn't. So we need to intersect policies that are not discriminatory and start thinking about changing it. Because until we change maternal policies, this isn't going to, even if we do great work in the healthcare. And, you know, gender is an issue here. Because most, you know, partners are both using. But really, you know, the mothers are really penalized. So there's a lot. I appreciate you bringing that up. So this is the other theory I wanted to discuss with you. It's another psychological theory. It's used in many health behavior studies with smoking cessation, medication-assisted treatment, but that if a healthcare provider or a social worker provides autonomy support, then you have increased positive outcomes. And it's the support for the patient's perception of autonomy and support for competence concerning their healthy behavior, right? So it's 2 factors here. Yeah, it's very similar to motivational interviewing. But we're saying that I believe in you, basically, right? That you have the ability to do this. So I'm just going to show you a really quick example from the qualitative health study of what this looks like in real time of autonomy support under the self-determination theoretical model. Pam shared, we actually nominated a lot of nurses for the NICU heroes, and we went back there to visit. If it wasn't for them, honestly, I wouldn't have come here. She's talking about intensive outpatient treatment center. We had this nurse, called her Nurse Kelly. She's this little lady. She needs an award. She's amazing. That lady became like a mother to me. Well, this woman happened to be in the hospital that I was working at. Because remember I said I went to 4 different New England states. So I went to we have 1,000 nurses in the NICU. So I went to the head nursing supervisor and I said, I need to meet Nurse Kelly. And she said, I have 2 Kellys. And I said, I want to meet the nice one. I know exactly who you're talking about, she said. So I went to Kelly and she's like really timid and, you know, soft-spoken. And she's looking at me, why do you want to talk with me? You know, a social worker? Why do you want to talk? What did I do, right? Guilty. I said, no, nothing. I just want to share something with you. Okay. She was so sweet. I get off, you know, my break is at 3. I'll meet you then. Okay, thank you, Kelly. So we met in the nurse's lounge. And I said, I conducted this study. I just want you to know that there was a participant in the study that shared that you were transformational in her entering treatment and getting help. She was so quiet. And then her lips started quivering. And then her eyes started getting glossy. She said, I don't know who you're talking about. I don't know who you're talking about. And I said, how are you a nurse? How do you practice your nursing? What do you do with your patients? And she said, I just treat everybody the same. And I said, keep doing that, Kelly, because it's working. It's working. But what she was doing is she was providing support for the patient's autonomy and competence in her as a mother. And that gave her the strength, the will, the motivation to pick up the phone and call. Because she had Kelly, who Kelly doesn't even remember. right? Because Kelly's just being herself, supportive nurse. And that's the power in self-determination. But just these, we're not going to go into these, but these are different models that can be really effective in all different settings. This one is from Canada. I feel like Canadians are a bit more advanced in this shared decision making, and I conducted a training with OBs at Brown University, and we also did some stigma exercises, and at the end there was a decrease in stigma and increase of resources, a knowledge of resources, because a lot of this is if I just ignore or if I label someone, then that protects me, that because I don't know what I'm doing. You know, this isn't my expertise. So it's like a self-protective thing. So what I found with training with nurses and physicians is increased knowledge of resources, that they're not isolated and they're not by themselves, and trying to connect them with community resources can be really helpful. But the center of this decision-making is also the patient or the client. Anybody familiar with the structural empowerment model? And that's it's similar to trauma-informed care, but you're really trying to address like power imbalances and liberation health model. You also bring in cultural and spiritual with health decisions, and then the recovery model is Boyle. Has anybody done read about Homeboy Industries in L.A.? Do you recommend everybody in this room reading it? It's life-changing. Homeboy Industries, it's called Tattoos on the Heart. And Boyle is a Jesuit priest, Irish, worked with, you know, mostly Latino gangs in the L.A. boroughs. And the model he uses is the recovery model. And it's very similar to what we've been discussing in the beginning of this workshop, providing that healing engagement community and meeting the client where they're at and just being available when the client's ready to come, and really just a very supportive model. There's now a second book to Tattoos on the Heart. They're both amazing, and I have all my MSW students read it, but it transformed my practice. It's that powerful of this recovery model. Because that's another group that's stigmatized, you know, people that are living in gangs and surrounded by community violence. This is just what the interprofessional shared decision making model looks like and kind of the different steps. But what's so crucial is you're bringing in the patient's values. So it's similar also to motivational interviewing, you know, and what are your ideas and what do you want? And then the team being whatever the team is, it could be maybe that the patient has identified someone too, you know, a partner or a family member. And then you go at the end, you can evaluate it. If it's not working, then you go back to the table. And that's okay. It's not like that something was bad. I'm sorry. Thank you. So we talked a little bit about the adversarial relationships, and I just that when you're doing this work and you're working with someone that may have a substance use disorder, you can experience countertransference. And more so with substance use for some reason, you know, that we're either angry or we're compassionate, right? I shared with you at the very beginning my biases of feeling that a mother that would do that is a monster. And then I went from pediatrics to women's health, and they were my patients. And that's when my framework started shifting, because all the pregnant women that I was working with were suffering from intimate partner violence, histories of trauma, adverse childhood experiences, poverty, classism, racism, and constantly battered. And then I realized me with white privilege is part of this. I'm part of the cog in the wheel here. And so my stance now is shifting to policy issues, because I was suffering from occupational burnout, this next slide, because in Rhode Island we were having 3 or 4 infants taken from their mothers every week. So that was traumatic for me, because I was part of a system that was harming and creating intergenerational trauma. But alcohol is a very difficult disease because it's legal and it's readily available. It's how we cope. I mean, how many of our friends say, I had a rough day, I'm going to have a glass of wine tonight? I mean, it's part of our culture, it's part of vernacular, and if I have an alcohol use disorder, that's tremendous. And I'm not making excuses for anyone, but I'm just saying that this disease precedes the pregnancy. You know, these aren't planned pregnancies, and it is a terrible consequence. It is. I want to just end with, and then I'll stick around for anybody that wants to chat, and I just have some resources for you all. This is from Boyle, The Tattoos on the Heart. And I love his definition of resilience, born by grounding yourself in your own loveliness, hitting notes you thought were way out of your range. So right before I was moving, I had one woman on a Saturday who had lost custody of her infant because her first infant had been adopted by her adoptive dad. Okay, and she had used substances prior in her first pregnancy. And a lot of times it's based on history. Yeah. So she had a social worker. The social worker left from DCF, and the new one assigned after she delivered this baby just decided to do an ex parte, which means didn't go into the apartment to see that she had anything for the baby, didn't go to see if she had nothing. So I come in after the fact, and she was sitting on a bench ready to leave, and she said, Heather, I just want to make sure that my infant is safe in the foster mom's car. She said, when I was 3, I remember being removed from my home in Worcester, Massachusetts. And her mother had cocaine use disorder, and she had I think she had 7 of the adverse childhood experiences. She said, I'm becoming my mother. And I said, Christine, I can go and ask the foster parent if you can just see that he's okay, but I can't promise you anything. She might say no. So I went to the foster parent, and the foster parent had this belief that this mother must be a monster if she's not taking her infant home. And I'm an ethical social worker, so I didn't coerce the foster parent, even though I wanted to. And I gave her autonomy. She didn't feel comfortable with it. So I had to go back and tell mom that she couldn't see her baby leave the hospital. And she had a therapist. So I said, can you take public transportation to see your therapist? Because I'm worried about you. And she said, yes, that's what I'll do. She had had a C-section. She had no one. She had no one to call. And she was going to do this. And I said, do you have food in your house? Who talked about Maslow's concrete needs? That's the only question after assessing her psychiatric safety. I was like, do you have food? And she's like, no, I don't have any food. And I said, I've never done this in 25 years of practice, but I'm leaving. I'm moving. So tell me, I can't get fired. Tell me your address. I'm going to drop off food. Now, she thought that I was just kidding, right? Because she's been hurt so many times from the system. And I'm just another social worker. She's been in the system since 3, remember? So I went into not a safe neighborhood in Providence and hid a bag of groceries in a bush next to a lot of contraband. And when she came home hours later and she saw that bag of food, it was the first time she decided that she was going to trust someone. So when I called her to check up on her, I said, would you accept a family support worker in your house? I have somebody that's phenomenal, and I think you're going to connect with her. I'm telling you, there's no way she would have said yes if I didn't bring that bag of food. Yeah. So she did get this family support worker. I called the Department of Health. I said, I want Melissa in there. She doesn't have her baby. Can you make the exception? Can you work with her? And they created a bond and a relationship. And she came twice a week to her. And 6 months later, she got her baby Erling back. And she's doing awesome. She's doing an online class. She's an honor student. She's getting her college degree in psychology. She wants to help kids that have been in the system. And I'm telling you, it was the bag of groceries. So it's these little things, and it's not vilifying and putting someone like that you're a bad person, you know. So what I wanted to give is these resources. This is going to be in the PowerPoint. But Recovery Answers is excellent. This is, we talked a lot about language. This is a group out of Boston, Mass General, and it has even a dictionary. Instead of a dictionary, it has every single term you could possibly need that's non-stigmatic, non-judgmental, and is starting to change the culture. It has every hot-off-the-press research study. It's the best site. It's excellent. Those are the tables that we did in the beginning, if you want more. This is out of SAMHSA Addiction Technology Transfer Center, and they have wonderful, wonderful videos, tutorials that are family-centered, strength-based. Anybody that is interested in maternal substance use or works in the hospitals, the nationalperinatal.org, they have excellent like infographics regarding NAS, regarding substance use that you can just freely download and print and put in your organizations. Anybody that's interested on the policy level, guttmacher.org. Let me spell it because I didn't put it on the slide. GuttMacher.org. GuttMacher.org. You can click on pregnancy, and then we'll have every single state. It will say if prenatal substance use is a criminal offense, if it's a civil charge, if some states have special programs, but it's updated every year. But that's a way to, if you want to get involved on a policy level of what your state's doing and advocate for more less punitive laws. So just to end, to thinking about health disparities and inequalities and maybe shifting this to social action, you know, and what we can do. Secondly, that where we can start is our language. And using substance use disorder, not labeling somebody an addict, having person-centered language so that your identity isn't a disease. The identity is the human. So person-centered language. And that we can all be supportive, especially as social workers, and make a difference, which is really exciting because this is intergenerational, right? So thank you all. Does anybody have any questions or comments?
Thank you.
I appreciate your involvement. Thank you.
We hope that you enjoyed this training. Please remember to take the post-test and the course evaluation in order to receive your CEU certificate. If you have any additional input or questions, please don't hesitate to contact us at the information you can find on our main webpage or email us at info@nacsw.org. We hope that you will consider taking additional courses on topics sensitive to the thoughtful integration of faith, spirituality, and social work practices through our program. Thanks again, and thanks for supporting NACSW.